Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Hey, Chris, I know you've been up in the Adirondacks and enjoying upstate New York. How's your summer going so far?
It's going great. The temperature is always about 15 degrees less than where we are in Atlanta.
That's such a nice thing to have a break from the heat.
Yes. Let's start this week's show with a statistic that I read and was quite struck by. So if you take half of the world's adult population, about 2.8 billion people, and add up everything they own, their houses, their savings, their belongings, minus their debts, and then you do the same for the 56,000 wealthiest adults on the planet, that would be a group small enough to fit inside a football stadium or even some baseball stadiums, the stadium's wealth would be three times greater than the wealth of the people of half of humanity combined.
Wow.
Three times.
That's pretty significant.
So Catholic social teaching does not say that inequality is bad.
That's correct.
That the earth and its resources are intended by God for the whole human race, though.
Very important principle of Catholic social teaching.
So
universal
some,
destination of goods is what it's called.
Yes. So some would say the distribution itself is now so distorted that it's hardly credible to claim that the universal destination of goods are reaching their proper destination for everyone.
Sure.
This number, like I said, is quite striking. As you know, I have no problem with the concept of billionaires or even trillionaires, so long as the wealth of individuals does not become monopolistic. But
I think the Catholic social teaching would go a little bit further, though, in this regard. And, you know, I can say this because, you know, I've seen this not only in Catholic social teaching, but in practice. I mean, I work with individuals who are very wealthy, but I also work with the very, very poor. With Catholic World Mission, I'm touching the needs of the church and the suffering members of humanity all across the world in 40 different countries on a regular basis. And then working with the Lumen Institute, I work with very wealthy individuals who are some of those, you know, millionaires and billionaires that you mentioned. So it's not just that it's okay that there are people who are very wealthy. It's also, I think, instilling in those who are wealthy a sense of responsibility, a sense of awareness of the needs of their brothers and sisters. And this is something that's not just on a practical level, which it is very practical, but it's also on a spiritual level. You know, when Jesus in the New Testament gave us the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, I see in that parable a powerful witness for the world today. You had this wealthy man who was condemned, not because he did something bad to Lazarus. He wasn't beating him. He wasn't throwing trash at him. Wasn't calling him a loser, go get a job.
Yeah, his sin was indifference.
Indifference. And just walking by him, pretending he didn't exist. This is the danger that all of us face. I mean, how often? I mean, I face it too, Chris. You know, I stop at a corner and there's a guy panhandling there. My human tendency is to pretend he doesn't exist. You know, if I don't look at him, he won't look at me, and then I won't feel so guilty. I try not to do that. I carry granola bars in my car, and I'll roll down my window, give the guy a granola bar, and say, hey, what's your name? Hey, I'll pray for you. Say a prayer for me, too. You know, just the human engagement doesn't allow me to isolate. You know, Jesus tells the parable of the Good Samaritan. Same thing. If I see the need of my brother and I remain indifferent, that's morally problematic for me. So I think the real issue in today's society is not inequality. It is the silencing of the conscience about how I am called to help my neighbor.
And I agree with that statement. I think that the image of a 56,000-person football stadium versus 2.8 billion people, and that's being three times the wealth inside the football stadium, is quite striking. But I would argue that the universal destination of goods is not being denied to the broader population, because let's say all of those individuals in that football stadium just put their money in the bank. Well, then the rest of the world borrows money at a lower cost because interest rates go down when there's more supply. And so the universal destination of goods is reaching people in other ways that we don't necessarily think about.
It certainly can. But I've had this conversation recently with a number of people because it's one of the really interesting things is to look at how Latin America has developed as opposed to the United States. A lot of times people will say, you know, banana republics and deficiency. Unfortunately, in many Latin American countries, they've turned to socialism as a way to remedy their societal ills. And we know how that's turned out. You know, look at Venezuela, one of the wealthiest countries from an oil standpoint in all of the world, and has a completely failed economy because of the practices of socialism.
They have the most reserves, oil reserves, of any country on the planet, more than Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, and look where they're at. And the recent earthquakes that devastated the country because of the lack of infrastructure and development, and people fleeing the country to come to the United States. And why are all these people from socialist countries fleeing to the United States? Because of a failed economic system. Why are Americans turning to socialism? It's bizarre. I mean, look what's happened in recent elections in New York,
right,
where we have a socialist mayor.
And now three new reps that will likely be in Congress.
Won the primaries, probably win in Congress. Yeah, so why are young people turning to socialism? I think it's because of arguments like this, of seeing this immense disparity between the very, very wealthy and the very poor.
And thinking that in and of itself is a bad thing.
And it's not. I mean, inequality will always exist with us. Essentially, I mean, because what is poverty? Poverty is a relative measure. So poverty, for example, here in the United States, a person who's, you know, under the level of poverty is, what, $28,000 a year or something like that. $28,000 a year would be like...
Would be more than those 2.8
zone,
more than those 2.8 billion people.
Totally. In most countries around the world, that would be in the wealth zone. So poverty is a relative term, and that's why Jesus said, the poor you will have with you always. So the problem is not inequality. The problem is in our own hearts. Am I becoming indifferent to the needs of my neighbor? Am I agglutinating stuff to myself and, you know, fortifying myself in a palace where I don't have to interact with my neighbor who is in need? And this is where I think Christianity is the differentiator in the world today. Because where Christianity is not being practiced, capitalism takes on this nature of greater inequality, which then stokes the fires of envy, and communism and socialism can look more attractive. So I think the answer to today's problems is a resurgence of Christian faith.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
A contributor to the Wall Street Journal opinion pages, who is a psychotherapist, argues that being trained in psychotherapy today amounts to being re-educated to interpret lives through the lens of oppressor and oppressed, i.e. critical theory.
Yep.
He starts off by citing a fellow therapist's email signature sign-off line that had the description, cis, queer, white, Euro-American, middle-class, post-evangelical, spiritual, but not religious.
Okay.
That's what
That's
his sign-off is for
wow.
every email.
Mm-hmm.
He says, this is evidence of the reinterpreting of ordinary human problems through a highly ideological vocabulary. He relates the story of an aspiring therapist who told him he thinks he chose the wrong profession. This fellow enjoyed working with patients, but remains unsettled about his graduate school experience. So during a seminar on family conflict, he suggested in a classroom dialogue that personal responsibility can shape how people respond to adversity. The room went quiet, he says. A classmate rather, then responded that such framing could ignore systemic oppression. And the others generally nodded in agreement. Another example was a female colleague who, while leading a group therapy exercise, invited a male student to comment on a discussion unfolding between two women. The professor stepped in and said, no, we don't need to insert a male voice. They already take up enough space in society. So
this was the professor who interjected with that.
Correct.
You know, right.
Mm-hmm. In other classes, this is a female who was saying, in other classes, she said discussions were routinely redirected toward the violence of whiteness or question her supposed instinct to protect white men. When she pushed back, she was told she might be better suited for corporate America, not psychotherapy. So experiences, yeah. Well, experiences like these, though, begin to sift out nonconformists and shape who remains in the field. So sure. In reading many of the comments to this article, there were scores of people chiming in saying they experienced exactly what these folks were talking about. They experienced it as patients rather than as therapists, right. You know. So what about this idea that seemingly no one can take personal responsibility and that everyone has to find somebody or something to
they're being
take
oppressed
fault.
By.
Yeah.
Well, it's a natural human tendency. We don't like to take responsibility for things. A lot of times we look for a scapegoat naturally. And I think some of these tendencies within the realm of psychology are really unhealthy. And, you know, over time they can be sifted out. You know, for someone who I think that there is a call to heal and to work within this realm of mental health. But you do need to have a solid base. And, you know, the Divine Mercy University outside of Washington, D.C. is an apostolate, a university that was started by our religious order, the Legionaries of Christ, a number of years ago, precisely because of this big vacuum in the field of psychotherapy.
Well, that's what I really want to ask
psychology.
You about here is if you – you know, assume that this is correct, that all psychotherapists, and I'm not, I know it's not all, but let's just for the sake of this argument, that they're all espousing the critical theory,
critical
oppressor
theory.
And oppressed. Is this, in your estimation, has it changed the role of priests where the priests sort of represent the other side in the confessional and you become psychotherapists representing a different view of the world? Has this increased in the confessional in your mind over the last, you know, couple of decades, or have priests always had that same role as a, quote, therapist in the confessional?
Priests has always had that role, and I think that many priests have also gotten some psychological training to be able to understand some of the dynamics that are going on from a psychological, not just a spiritual level. So, and that's part of our formation and preparation for the priesthood, some of that. Some priests go and get further formation in that. But it's a really interesting world because there are lots of different theories that impact psychological practice and therapists, some of them which are not aligned with the Christian worldview, others that are closer, more closely aligned. So I think, for example, I mean, Freud, many of his theories were really off base and reinterpreting religious experience, whereas Carl Jung, many of his theories actually rejected Freud and came back to closer to what a Christian worldview would be. And this is where I think the genius of Divine Mercy University has been, is because it's navigated this realm of the psychological sciences while retaining a really clear Catholic and Christian worldview. In fact, they've come up with a meta model for the psychological sciences that guides all of their courses. I've worked pretty closely with Father Charles Sikorsky and Father Lino Otero, who are there at the university, some of the other priests and great lay people, Dr. Paul Witz, some really luminaries in the field of the psychological sciences, who have come together to say, no, let's not accept the main narrative of many of those who are in the psychological field. Let's sift through it and see what's valid and what's not.
But what I get the sense, just anecdotally, that priests have become more and more therapists, you know, particularly in the confessional, versus, let's say, a priest in 1960. Do you think they spent as much time at the confessional as a priest from 2026 does? Because of this...
For the individual confessions?
Yeah, because people can't find proper therapy elsewhere. That's what I'm getting at.
That's a complicated question. And I think priests back in the 1940s probably spent more time in the confessional and less time with each individual penitent.
Right.
Oftentimes what's happening nowadays is that, you know, people are complicated and convoluted and they've got real serious problems. And sometimes a priest has to spend more time with an individual. Sometimes a priest has studied too much psychology and then they get into becoming a therapist. But that's not our role as a priest. We are a priest. We are there in persona Christi to bring pardon and forgiveness to the soul, peace to their soul. Sometimes you can touch on psychological topics, but you got to respect your role as not being a therapist. I am, as a priest, I am not a therapist. I know things about psychology, and I'm going to point people to a psychologist or a therapist when I see that there is a need for it. And I think it's important to recognize the distinction of roles.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com. Crossed Wires.
On June 14th, 2026, Switzerland voted to reject a proposed cap on their population with a ballot initiative that said the population must not exceed 10 million people before the year 2020. So this was a ballot referendum that proposed that they would cap the population at 10 million people. So under the initiative, if it had passed, if the population had reached 9.5 million people before the year 2050, the government would be forced to restrict asylum. Any family reunification or residency permits would have to be
deferred.
Right. Mm-hmm. And they would also have had to have scrapped Switzerland's EU deal on the free movement of people within across borders. So the proposal didn't say what would happen if the Swiss population were to grow past that number due to organic growth through births, because, of course, they're not going to do that. They're not having children over in Switzerland or anywhere in Europe.
Right. They're below replacement rate.
So what would the church say about countries imposing a population cap?
I think it's foolish. I mean, one of the things that drives the economy of a country is having a younger population. And this is a major issue that a lot of countries in Europe and a few countries in Asia are facing. And I mean, any country that really looks at the data is going to say that's a bad policy.
I agree. But this is different than China's one-child policy, which was focused on abortion and contraception.
Sure.
Okay, the rigidity of a hard cap is different than what China was trying to do with their one-child policy. So let's say a nation that is like a city-state like Singapore just literally doesn't have—
No space to grow.
Right. And they impose a cap. Would the church be against Singapore or even Vatican City?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've never really thought about that. It'd be an interesting thought experience to work through and say, okay, what are the moral implications of that? Just kind of a quick stab at it. I don't see any problem with saying, hey, we don't want to grow beyond this point. Then the real question is how? How do you implement that? Because do you do a mandatory death policy? Okay. Anyone over the age of 65, all right, you're going to be euthanized.
Right. Okay. Thanks for coming out.
We enjoyed your contribution to society. You're no longer a productive member of society, so we're going to get rid of you.
Right.
Or a mandatory abortion policy.
Right. Obviously,
or
those
anti-immigration
aren't.
So the how, I think,
right.
is
those
really
are not going to be in conformity with church teaching.
Correct.
But these asylum caps and other, like say the equivalent of a green card, like in the U.S., would be, there's no moral implications to those, I would think, on the same level as
it depends.
What you're talking about.
Again, it depends on exactly how you implement that and if there are forms of discrimination that are built into it. So I think you go back to the kind of the baseline principles of Catholic social teaching and Catholic morality. And, it's respect for the dignity of the human person, respect the different, the natural rights that people have with their natural responsibilities. And let's ensure that we're putting those principles into play.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
A new study in Scientific Reports analyzed lyrics from hundreds of thousands of English language songs across two data sets. So one data set covered 375,000 songs from 1960 to 2010, and another covered 5,500 songs from 1960 to 2023. And they were tracking the moral content of popular music and how it shifted over the past 60 years.
Interesting.
They used AI to detect moral themes based on five categories from moral psychology, such as relationship cheating, like you might find in country music songs, to harm and degradation lyrics that you might find in, say, rap music.
Can I ask you a quick question? So what music genre was it pulling from? Was it just all different music
all
genres? All English music in those time periods.
And so in one of those data sets, it was songs that were in the Billboard top 100
okay,
of any category.
Yeah, because more like the mainstream songs that
are
out
the popular
there.
Songs.
Yep.
So so in both sets, they studied degradation, harm, cheating, and subversion, and they determined that all of those subject matters in these songs rose dramatically over the past six decades.
Mm-hmm.
So
no surprise.
So my question to you is, do you think that pop music is just a cultural mirror? Or is the music actually causing culture to change?
Both.
But which one do you think takes precedence?
Well, let's look at it a little bit different way. When you're those who are making the music are a reflection of the culture. They grew up, they imbibe certain things, and they're reflecting their experiences in their music. But then they are in then impacting the ones coming after them. So they are the ones who are more of a recipient of
that. Yeah, and I agree. I think both are true. But I do believe that when you marinate in lyrics that normalize rule breaking or cheating,
there's no doubt
that it's especially for the developing brains of teenagers and young people that it's absolutely affecting change in the culture. I think really it's that's to me is the more that's the leading element of this rather than it being cultural. It is also a cultural mirror, but I believe that music is in part affecting change, and then it's changing as a cultural mirror as well.
It certainly does. And even in the history of the church, it's really fascinating to look back at how many saints used music to evangelize. They would come up with Eucharistic songs, or St. Thomas Aquinas wrote the Pange Lingua for the Eucharistic processions, and we still sing it to this day. So music is a medium for evangelization and for shifting a culture, there's no doubt. Just like entertainment is and comedy, they're all forms of shifting a culture unmistakably.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com. Crossed
Wires. In roughly 100 hours, Eric Swalwell went from frontrunner in the California governor's race to abandoning his House seat in disgrace with allegations of criminal sexual assault and sexual harassment of subordinates in his congressional office. The most explosive allegations include him being accused of drugging women for a sexual assault. His exit from both the governor's race as well as Congress were the result of an intense, unusually quick pressure campaign from his fellow Democratic lawmakers, notably led by one-time mentor Nancy Pelosi.
And it would be interesting to see if they had taken a different tack there. I mean, what if they had actually defended him?
Well, that's what happened.
He probably wouldn't have
resigned. That's what happened on the other side of the country. So I want you to contrast this with the case of Graham Platner. So he is in the Maine senatorial race. His record—
And this is in the state of Maine.
Correct. We're contrasting California and Maine here. And this guy, Platner, his record includes inflammatory online posts, sexually explicit messages exchanged with several women while married, and allegations from ex-girlfriends of a history of rape fantasies, heavy drinking, and violent behavior, plus a Nazi-linked tattoo that he says he didn't know was linked to Nazism when he got it, but which one ex-girlfriend says he always knew. So rather than a Pelosi-style pressure campaign, California Congressman Ro Khanna campaigned for him, saying Platner had sought redemption, and Bernie Sanders endorsed him and stuck by that endorsement. Until he ended up clinching the Democratic nomination here for Maine, so he'll be running in the fall as their candidate for the Senate. So the Democratic leadership mobilized the institutional machinery to destroy one of their own in 4 days, while the other one they stuck by. So the Believe Women standard that was applied to Swalwell was basically disregarded with Platner.
Right.
So there's two things I want to discuss here.
Political expediency.
Yeah.
I think it boils down to that.
That's right.
But let's unpack this a little bit more, Chris.
All right. So one is Barton Swain, an editorial writer in the Wall Street Journal. He argues that the scandal around Swalwell is another product of the sexual anarchy bequeathed to us by the 1960s. He says revelations of insatiable male behavior from Bill Cosby to the Me Too wave to Jeff Epstein no longer shock, as they're just so common. He thinks that the loss of human sacredness, which depended on the belief in God, underlies the moral confusion we keep lamenting without understanding. So what do you think of his assessment that this boorish male behavior is something that is born out of the 1960s sexual revolution?
Well, there's no doubt that that's one of the factors that's contributed to it. And it has become more acceptable because we see it more. And we've taken things to even further extremes that people won't blink at anymore. So there is a degradation of our moral sense in our society that is problematic.
Yeah, and I think of just the language that we used in mixed company, where I can't imagine my parents, my dad speaking, using F-bombs in the company of women.
Oh, no
and
way.
There's
right.
just no no thought about talking the way people talk in today's culture.
Yeah, and the way that we win that back is by people actually let's be leaders, not just followers. And if we truly believe that, you know, language should convey good things and lead people to good, well, try to excise the swear words out of your vocabulary.
Well, I think you already addressed this, but what about this idea that the Me Too movement is being invoked only when it's convenient? So in California, no matter what, a Democratic governor is going to be elected. And so Swalwell was disposable because whoever's going to replace him is going to get elected. Whereas in Maine, the seat currently is occupied by a Republican, and this guy Plattner is, you know, their chance to flip a currently Republican held seat. So that's why they just said, forget the Me Too, believe women, and let's say that he has sought redemption and let's back him anyways. It's just, like you said, political expediency.
Yeah. I mean, it comes down to a cold calculation at times, which is pretty ugly. But I think this double standard is something, you know, we've got to get rid of the double standard. I think that we should be living up to what we, you know, what is good for society.
Well, one thing about both guys, they both are sort of macho characters, okay? They're muscle-bound, big guys, macho types that I think the Democratic Party is searching for. So compare these two candidates with this guy, Tallarico, who's running for Senate in Texas.
In Texas, yeah.
He's definitely more effeminate character. And I think the party is really trying to find somebody who speaks to the young males that they have lost in their electorate.
Well, they've alienated because of the leftist causes that they've started to ascribe to him. A lot of young men are just abandoning it. It's like, this is ridiculous.
Right. And this guy, Plattner, is a tattered up lobster boat captain, even though I think his lobster boat it was given to him by his parents. I think the money came from his parents. He didn't, you know, he's not like...
he's not a self-made man.
Right. But because he's that, you know, that archetype, they want to support him no matter what because they're trying some way, somehow to retain some of that young male population in their electorate that they've lost.
Interesting.
Yeah. The Wall Street Journal did a story on elementary school age children who are receiving weight loss drugs such as Ozempic, despite that the fact that the medications aren't medically approved for obesity in this age group. Doctors worry about putting growing children on these types of meds as they worry about insufficient calorie and nutrient intake, compromising bone growth, puberty, and brain development. And no one knows the consequences, the potential consequences of being on these drugs for decades starting in childhood. What do you think about this? Is giving your children Ozempic rise to the level of being immoral, or is this just stupid?
Great question. I think those kids should just get outside and play a little bit more. Maybe if they were outside and doing some activity, you know, hey, maybe we could even bring back child labor.
Well, it's stupidity in my mind. I don't think it's immoral, but there is a solution to kids who are overweight. Exercise and, hey, no processed food.
That's right.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crossed Wires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.